All right, everyone, welcome back to Coach's Corner here on Relay. We have taken a bit of a break from Coach's Corner, but we are back today. I'm Stephanie Flippin. I'm joined by my co-host here, Peter Bromka.
Hello.
And we are, hello, Peter. And we are looking to take Coach's Corner in a couple new directions. So today we have our first guest on, Mario Fraioli, coach and competitive athlete for the last 20 to 30 years at this point. We're so excited to have him here with us, and we're very much looking forward to speaking with him about his illustrious coaching career and what he's been up to. So welcome, Mario.
Thank you so much for having me. Illustrious is quite an adjective to use. I'm honored.
I'm curious, Mario, you have done a lot of hosting and you've been on a lot of podcasts. Where is your comfort zone? Like, I mean, you don't have any out right now, but like compare the two for us.
I much prefer to be in the host seat because I feel, I don't want to say I feel more in control, but I'm driving the conversation as the host, and I just get to explore my curiosity, and I'm much more interested in that than talking about myself. So it feels more natural for me to be the person asking questions.
Sure. I also meant to mention as well that Mario is the host of the Morning Shakeout, the podcast, and both the very popular newsletter. And I think I would be remiss if I didn't also mention that Mario is also Peter's coach. So we have a unique relationship here.
I was wondering if we were going to slide that minor detail.
We should just kick that off the top. I mean, it's funny, Mario. I'm curious. I think many people will probably know your name. I'm trying to context set because we ran against each other 2 decades ago, a little over 2 decades ago, and didn't know each other well in college, but then have gotten more back in touch. And then I guess a year and a half ago, I reached out and said, like, hey, man, what if you coach me? Which is something maybe we could discuss a little bit down the road in this call. But I'm curious about... You reach people, through your newsletter. That's, congratulations, like approaching a decade old, like really moving that direction.
Close, yeah.
The podcast, which I think at times you've told me reaches an overlapping, certainly, but also a quite different audience. And then you show up, well, you've written a lot of content on other platforms, sort of as a coach, a lot of competitor articles over the years. I know a lot of people I interact with say like, oh, I read about this workout from Coach Mario any number of years ago. You coach
Golden Gate Triathlon Club.
Golden Gate Triathlon Club. Okay.
I'm the running programs for that group.
Okay, so that's Wednesday nights at the track. And then as a one-to-one virtual coach, which is how we connect. I'm just curious, like, how does that, this is like a big question, but for you, like, how do you think about like connecting with those different audiences? Like,
I mean, I'm an introvert by nature. I prefer one-on-one interactions or very small group type of settings. I don't do well in, in large gatherings. Definitely not my comfort zone. So a lot of the coaching that I do is very one-on-one in nature. And I really like that aspect of it. I do work with the Golden Gate Triathlon Club here in San Francisco, and I'm at the track every Wednesday night, and during the fall we'll have a marathon program or trail program, and we'll get together on the weekends, and it's a sizable group, but I'm okay in those settings like once or twice a week, and then I get to reset. But I really like the one-on-one nature of my coaching relationships. But even the writing that I do or the content that I put out into the world, I can see and I know that a lot of people read it or will listen to the podcast, but one, I'm not in the same room with those people. So it almost feels like, and this is why I created the newsletter and the podcast to begin with, I wanted to create something that I myself would like to read or listen to. So I'm essentially the target audience for both of those things. And when I hear back from people, especially via the newsletter, it's a one-to-one relationship. Even though it goes out to a lot of people, only you can reply. So we can have a one-to-one conversation. I just prefer those types of interactions, but I don't really give it a lot of thought beyond that.
Yeah, I think something that I was thinking about just now, throughout like you just walking us through those types of relationships and your preference for that one-on-one connection, is I think at least to me, like you really stand out as one of those coaches in the space that has built very long-term relationships with some of your athletes. I mean, a lot of your athletes. I mean, someone like Tim Tollefson comes to mind. Someone I'm not sure, like correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you two have probably been working together for close to a decade
10 years.
At this point. Yeah. But yeah, I'm curious what that's been like. I feel like they're like we are familiar with those types of long-term relationships, maybe more so with like professional like track and road athletes, but maybe not so much in the trail and ultra world. But what has that been like for you to work with such high-level athletes over the years and compounding that relationship?
Yeah, it's a privilege to work with any athletes, whether they are an elite or they're an amateur age grouper just chasing their own goals. And back to what we were just talking about in the previous question, I really value those individual relationships and I treat them as such. And I think, for coaching to work, you've got to give it time, right? So I place a lot of value in being able to, build and cultivate those relationships over a long period of time, because I think that's ultimately when we're going to see success and unlock potential. And it doesn't matter what level the athlete is at. I mean, that's probably the top thing that I pride myself on as a coach, is that I do tend to work with people for a fairly extended period of time. And usually that's when we end up seeing some great results. But over the course of that relationship, it strengthens, that trust grows. And I think that's really, I think that's really important in any successful relationship, but certainly like coach athlete relationship, is that longevity piece to it.
Do you ever get nervous? I think of like Tim finishing on the podium at UTMB. Like it starts to be like, wow, like this guy's capable of a lot. We've known that for years, but it's like, I mean, I imagine, you'd worked with him for years before he has those performances. But I think one thing I'm always mindful of is, yes, consistency. And, you talk a lot through newsletter, through your podcast, now on social media again, which we can get into, about like, consistent small wins and building up. But like, if you're going to finish on the podium at UTMB, you got to take some swings. And like, how do you think about the like, oh, whoa, like this is the top. I'm often mesmerized by like with outlier performances, maybe you could tell me they don't require outlier attempts in training or outlier, plans to like push each other, you and the athlete.
Yeah, outlier is an interesting word. I don't know if it's so much that as it is being willing to take a big swing. And that goes for if you're trying to get on the podium at a major race like UTMB, or if you're trying to break a barrier in the marathon, 3 hours, 2.5 hours, whatever it happens to be. Those are reaches. They're stretch goals in a way, but they're not unrealistic. I mean, we have to see in the training and the preparation and the lead up, hey, I think you're capable of this. And in Tim's case, we knew that he was capable on the right day of being on the podium at UTMB, but we also knew that it wasn't a guarantee. He was going to have to take some risks there and put himself in position to do that, because it is such a competitive race. And in that case, you are competing against other people, not just the clock. So you have to respond to what's happening around you. And if, Kilian Jornet makes a big move and that's going to stretch out the field, you've got to make some decisions. If you really want to put yourself in contention to end up in a podium spot. And Tim's done that and it's panned out a few times, and other times it hasn't. And I think that's just the nature of sport. But I don't see that as any different than someone who's a, say, 308 marathoner and they want to break 3 hours. That's a pretty big jump. You've got to go 9 or 10 minutes faster, and your training should show that you're capable of that. But you have to believe that you're able to do that on the day itself and be willing to ride that line and put yourself in position to do that, because without that, it's not going to happen. So I think whatever the goal is for the athlete, there is, a little bit of, risk or bravado involved, saying like, I think I'm capable of this and I'm going to give it a swing, and I might not do it. I may fail, but I'm willing to take the try. And either way, you're going to learn something from that. You're going to learn that, yes, I was capable of that, or maybe I'm not there just yet, and I've got to tweak X, Y, and Z things, and we'll do a few things differently the next time out, and then we'll try again.
You know, you work with a handful of athletes who have been like quite outspoken in really admirable ways about like their mental health and just being a very holistically healthy athlete, Tim being one of them. But I'm curious, like your mention of encouraging the athlete and being like, hey, like, we know you're capable of this, but it's going to take, taking risks. I'm curious how you approach things just in terms of maybe like elements of imposter syndrome. I mean, as we know, like imposter syndrome isn't unique to the amateur like age group athlete. I'm just curious how you meet your athlete like where they are and help sort of develop their confidence in taking those big swings on these big stages and a big stage relative to the athlete, amateur or professional.
Yeah, the first step, and I think this is what takes time, is getting to know the athlete as a person and not just an athlete. And, how this pursuit of, in my case, as a coach, competitive running fits into their life, what it is that they want to get out of it, how they see themselves when they step onto the start line or in a particular arena. It's important for me to know like what it is that I'm working with the athlete, so I can understand that and have that in mind when I'm, writing out their training, when we're talking about race plans, those sorts of things. Because I think without that, it just becomes very mechanical. You're putting numbers in place and saying, all right, if we do X, Y, and Z, you can do blah, 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 type of thing. So I think it's important to get to know the athlete, and that's always the first step for me, is on a very personal level, just getting to know them, where they are in their life, how their relationship with running has evolved to that point, where they would like it to go. And especially with the athletes that I've been fortunate enough to work with for several years, Tim's a great case, and he's definitely talked a lot about this on podcasts and videos that have been done about him. Just understanding how that relationship and seeing how that relationship has evolved over time, and knowing what he has struggled with when he has stepped to the start line, and even when the race has gone well, to know like why he wasn't feeling particularly fulfilled by what should be an amazing accomplishment, and what maybe we can do to help reframe that going into the next training cycle for the next event. So yes, that we can get an objectively good result, but he can also walk away from the finish line being like, I feel really good about that performance and how I showed up on the day and expressed myself.
I imagine you must ebb and flow in your sense of their confidence in themselves, like Stephanie's saying, or maybe their just like ability to perform at their best. And like, I'm always curious how coaches sort of navigate that when you get the inkling, oh, this person's going through some stuff. They might acknowledge it to themselves, or they might not be acknowledging it. And like, you're still having to write the plan. And how do you, I guess, match them there without like calling them out or, pushing them too hard?
Sure. I think a lot of that comes from just paying attention and having consistent interactions with the athlete and understanding, where they are at just in their life, and certainly in their training as well, and where those two things like interact and intersect at any given time. And because you're the person asking me these questions and I coach you, I'm going to flip it on to you, Peter. You're a pretty good example of this. And I mean, we can get as far into it as you would like to, but in the time that we've been working together, which I think is about a year and a half now, we'd known each other long before that. You trained with one of my other athletes, Chris Maxwell. You're on the same club together. So I knew you, and I knew generally what was going on in your life, but I also had to understand where you were when we started and what it is that you wanted to get out of the sport and maybe what was getting in the way of that. And I mean, a lot of the conversations that we've had haven't had a whole lot to do with the X's and O's of your workouts. It's really understanding how you're feeling about how all that's fitting in right now, and what may be, a blocker to your ability to, and I'm not saying this to call
No.
you out, but train consistently
Yeah.
or get in the workouts that you need to get in, and like me trying to understand, why that might be the case, and how I might be able to help, but also what's beyond, my ability to do anything about it,
Yeah.
as a coach, and just sort of you know, walk that part of the path with you. And then hopefully over time, and we're starting to see this now, like, you know, rebuild that momentum and help the pieces to kind of fall, or help put the pieces back, you know, into place so that we can find that consistency where things are clicking again and you feel like you're, you know, sort of in a groove. I don't know if that really answers
your
question.
No, it feels fair. I mean, I think I asked the question and then I realized like, oh, wow, I'm a lead example of that. Yeah. I've given Mario credit before, or I've said, you know, I haven't always given him enough to work with. Like, you always, as an athlete, want to, if you're working with a coach, you just want to like give them your best and show up for, you know, hold up your end of the bargain. Mario and I started working together in the summer of 22. My mom mm-hmm. passed away in August of 22, yeah. and it really has changed a lot about my life. It's mm-hmm. something I'm still navigating. Right. And so there's been times where, you know, to be honest, I'm like, I bet Mario can see this from afar, even if we're not chatting daily about, particularly because you're aware from a distance of what my training was like in the years past. So it's like, you know, I would almost catch myself and be like, I'm just acknowledging this, that maybe like this interim race or this interim workout is only going to go so well. I bet Mario is able to see it, you know, slightly outside that fog of, you know, first person experience. And, you know, I think it's hopefully in that trusting relationship, you can push each other. While also, like, I know that at times you've had to give me my space and just be like, he's going to come to it. I mean, at one point last fall, I called out, I just said, I shot you a note, like, I'm not sleeping enough. Like, mm-hmm. and I think you use this phrase on social media recently, this idea of, are you enduring the training or are you absorbing the training?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, one of the maxims that I live by is data drives the discussion and the discussion drives our decisions. So I can't just make decisions based on data alone because it needs context. I could see that I give you 5 by a mile in 5:15 and I see, oh, all right, they were all between like 5:12 and 5:15. That was a great workout. But until I ask you, how did you feel? How did it go? I don't know. Maybe you cruise through those, but maybe it was like, yeah, I was turning myself inside out to hit all of those, which isn't what we mm-hmm. wanted. And that gives me some good context and that's going to help me to make some decisions for you moving forward, but also understanding, well, why was that the case? You know, is it mm-hmm. because fatigue is accumulating just from training and we need to make some adjustments there? Do you have other stresses in your life that might be, you know, contributing to that? I try to paint as broad of a picture as I can, because all of that context is, you know, is super important. I think that's what it means to walk alongside the athlete and to really ask the right questions and realize, like, training, whether you're an amateur or even a pro, but certainly for the amateurs amongst us, it does not exist in a silo. There's a lot of other mm-hmm. stuff going on in our lives. It's not just a physical investment. It's a mental investment. It's an emotional investment. It's a time investment. And mm-hmm. and really, you know, understanding the toll of, you know, all of that. And, you know, in your case, Peter, going back to when we started working together, you know, you are trying to get back into training consistently and training hard and going after goals after, one, not just, you know, losing your mom, which is a life-changing event, but also, you know, if we go back a little further than that, your pursuit before that point, and I know this very intimately, was chasing that OTQ and took yeah. 3 big swings at it in a relatively short period of time. And just, no, and we've talked a lot about this, like, you were training hard for those things, but also just, you know, what that took out of your emotional tank. And then yeah. how do you pick yourself up after this thing is done and dusted and think about what is, you know, what is next? And like, we've had a lot of conversations along, you know, along those lines as well. And sometimes it just takes time, you know, and I yeah. think that's a big part of it too. And something mm-hmm. that I've gotten more comfortable with in the amount of time that I'm coaching, I think a lot of younger coaches struggle with, and I certainly did when I was younger. And I think our world sort of pushes on us right now. It's got to be instant. Things have to happen mm-hmm. right away. It takes time to figure some things out. And that could be the coach trying to figure out how to get the athlete on the right track so that they can, you know, accomplish their goals, but also for the athlete to figure out possibly like where they are and how this thing is going to fit in and what adjustments they may need to make in their life and how they may need to rethink about, you know, their goals so that they can get back to that spot where running is fitting in well. You know, they're able to get in the work pretty consistently. They're absorbing the training, as we were talking about, and not just tolerating it. And sometimes that just takes time and patience, which I think we could probably all work on a little bit more in our lives.
Just this common theme that I'm observing, like in this recent topic that we're on right now, is just sort of walking with the athlete and being with them and understanding like that their journey is an evolution. It's dynamic. It's constantly changing. Like you, Peter, right? Like you're not the same athlete that you were, you know, like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, a year ago. And that I don't even mean that in like a fitness perspective either, right? Like your relationship is constantly changing. All of our relationships with the sport is constantly changing. And Mario, Peter and I had touched base before we hopped on just about the fact that you decided to take a step back from social media. Mm-hmm. And then you recently returned. And I'm just curious, like, what's your thought process, whatever you feel comfortable with sharing about that decision. And maybe just to speak a little bit more about what you've noticed in the past few years, like just the impact of social media on maybe some of your athletes' health, maybe like your health too. Again, whatever you feel comfortable sharing.
Yeah. So the reason that I stepped away from social media at this point, it's 3.5 years ago, but I was away from Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all of it for 3 years. And I don't have a Facebook account anymore. I don't have a Twitter account. All I have is Instagram. But I stepped away for a couple reasons. One, I noticed that it was consuming a lot of my time and attention. I did not have a healthy relationship with these platforms, and that was distracting me from what it is that I really needed to focus on. And I also noticed, this was Twitter in particular, and I think it kind of drove the whole thing, but that platform in particular was just becoming so incredibly toxic and unproductive that I didn't really want to spend any time there. And so I just, because this is the way my personality works, I just cut it all out. I was like, I'm just going to go, it's all or nothing. So I cut it all out. Instagram allows you to essentially deactivate your account without completely deleting it. So, you know, unless I log in, it doesn't show up anywhere. People aren't seeing my feed. I just don't exist on Instagram for, you know, all intents and purposes, unless I log back in and reactivate the account. So, you know, after 3 years away, I was able to observe a lot of things. And the truth is, for better or worse, a lot of people spend a lot of time on social media, Instagram in particular, at least folks around my age. I'm in my early 40s, so call it, you know, mid-30s to mid-50s, that's probably where most of them are spending a lot of their time. And, you know, my newsletter continued during this time, my podcast continued during this time, but they're kind of opt-in. Like, you have to sign up for my newsletter to get it. If you don't want to get it, you can unsubscribe, no problem. So, and the people who do subscribe tend to read it every week. So that's great. And it's not beholden to an algorithm. I really love that about it. And, you know, a once a week cadence felt very sustainable for me. Social media, as we all know, it rewards your attention, and the more time you spend on it and the more that you post, I hate that aspect of it.
Yeah.
But I had to accept, and I accepted this after just observing after several years, that's where people spend a lot of their time. And, you know, Peter would do this, other friends and athletes of mine would just send me stuff that they found on social media. Check this out. And I get sent just a lot of crap, honestly, like just a lot of crap, especially when it comes to coaching or training for running or whatever the, you know, latest and greatest thing is. And this is where people are spending their time. You know, I don't want to go on there and go after anyone in particular, but I want to meet people where they are and share good information. I mean, that's really it. So I thought a lot about this for, you know, for several months. I put I call them the rules of engagement. I have them in place of how I'm going to use it. It's just Instagram. I didn't reactivate any of the other ones. I don't use Threads or anything like that. But, you know, Instagram, I think, can be a place where you can reach people and share good information in an impactful way. And so I wrote my rules of engagement of how often that I'm going to use the platform, what it is that I'm going to, you know, post about, what it is that I'm not going to do. And I've been like very bullish about sticking to, you know, those rules of engagement. And that has helped. Like, solve the first problem, which was just my own addiction to these platforms where I'd sit there and just mindlessly be scrolling, for hours. And all of a sudden it's like, well, where did the last like 75 minutes go? I give myself 20 minutes a day. I set the alarm on there and that's it. All the stuff that I post is pre-planned. A lot of it comes right from the newsletter, or I'll make a slide in Canva. I don't create anything specifically for Instagram with the exception of two posts. One, the re-intro post of, hey, I'm back on Instagram. I obviously had to create that. And then when I had my athlete, Zach Hind at the Olympic trials a couple weeks ago, I put a post up about him, and I did that pretty quick, that morning. So I'm not spending time there like, oh, what am I going to say today? I'm very intentional about it. And a lot of it, honestly, and this is by design, starts in the newsletter. And then I will pull it out of the newsletter. I'll either find a photo to go with it, or I'll create a slide, and I just schedule it to post at a specific time. So I don't even have to think about it. But, I set the limit at 20 minutes per day, and that's for me to just kind of scroll, see what's there, respond to, comments or DMs that come in. Usually when I share stories, it's like 10 at a time because I'm just doing it all at once. I batch it, which I do with a lot of other things in my life as well. And that's it. I'm out. And then I leave it. I feel like I've accomplished the goal of reaching people where they are. I've put posts up that some of them I wrote years ago, but they're sort of evergreen in their message, and people thank me for posting it or say this hit me at the right time, and that's great. That's really what I wanted it to do. And I don't look at the numbers, but I think people have found me there that didn't know that I had a newsletter, didn't know that I had a podcast, and from there they can dig deeper into other art, like hundreds of articles that I've written on the internet, hundreds of podcasts that I've put out into the world, or even look through, the old newsletters and, find some stuff there. So I think it's, I think it's been a good move back, but, without that time away, I think it's easy to get completely consumed by, not just Instagram, but any of these platforms that just command all your attention at all times.
I guess for me, Peter and I are both coaches too, but as an athlete and as an athlete with high performance goals and trying to compete at the highest level, like in the trail and ultra world, I've certainly noticed for myself just the impact that social media has. And I go back and forth between, I think it's wonderful, right? Especially in the trail world, with media picking up and more light being shown on the sport. I think it's great. It's wonderful for the sport to get it out there and more accessible to more people. But I have just noted, I even find myself, I'm also coming back from fairly significant injury too. So, just setting those boundaries, like you mentioned, has been really important, even on Strava as well, or the fact that I live at super high altitude. So cardiovascularly, I can't hit the same paces as some of my competitors, that live at sea level. But I'm just curious, have you noticed just with the uptick in social media and I mentioned, this increase in media coverage in general, track and field as well, but have you noticed any trends as a coach, with your athletes and perhaps having to have discussions about what you just mentioned that you had to go through personally in terms of setting those boundaries?
Yeah, 100%. And I've seen an uptick in this over the last few years, but it's the comparison trap. It's easy to fall into. And I feel like Instagram and Strava are probably the two biggest culprits. I think Strava can be a great platform, but I also think it can be dangerous for a lot of people because it's hard not to look at someone's numbers or scrutinize your own that go up and compare them to, compare them to others. And I've had athletes that I've encouraged to get off Strava, just flat out. It's not serving you. And I can analyze your data through Final Search, which is the platform that I use for coaching just fine. So I don't need it. I do think, and this is a whole nother topic, I do think the way Strava presents some of their data, especially on the desktop, is better than some of the other platforms, but it's not absolutely, necessary. But I do see a lot of athletes just, scrolling their feed or looking people up and comparing themselves to what they've done. They know of athletes in their area, or even now it could be anywhere in the world, who have similar goals, and they'll be like, oh my god, they common example is, they ran their 20 miler in 2.5 hours and mine took me 2:42, and you know, they're trying to do the same thing that I am. It's like, mm-hmm. stop that. Like, it's just not mm-hmm. serving you. And, you know, I've had to ask a lot of those questions, because oftentimes, you know, unless it comes up in conversation, which it doesn't, unless prompted, I'm not going to hear about it. But
sure.
You know, in those conversations with athletes, as we start to peel back the layers, usually about, you know, why did you feel like that long run really sucked? Like, did it suck because you mm-hmm. didn't feel good, or you didn't hit your mm-hmm. splits, or did it suck because you got onto Strava a couple hours later and you saw someone else did a very similar workout and they were, you know, 10 seconds a mile faster than you, type of thing. I mean, and that's the thing about, you know, whether it's a social media platform, and I also see this like in person in a team environment, and I'm sure, Peter, you have too, and Stephanie, mm-hmm. I don't know your experience being with teams, but you know, if you're in a group or you're part of a community, someone's feeling good every day. Like, yeah. someone's going to be feeling good, and someone's mm-hmm. going to be killing it, or at least giving the appearance that they are killing it. And that's what you're going to see. You're not going to see, you know, the exact opposite of that. And, you know, I think that can be inspirational when you see, oh my goodness, this person's getting out there every day and they're putting in the work. You know, I want to be more like them. Like, I think that can be positive. That's great. That's a benefit of, you know, mm-hmm. these platforms. But I more often see the opposite of that, where folks will just start playing the comparison game and don't feel like they're enough, or they haven't been doing enough. And that can mess with you, certainly mentally, but, you know, also if you start adjusting your training in response to what you see other people yeah. do, that's not going to work. I can promise you that is not going to work. It's only going to lead to like injury, frustration, burnout, or something worse. So,
yeah, like a certain amount of that community, digital community and awareness can feel like warmth and like belonging, because mm-hmm. these things we're trying to do, there's not that many people like that you interact with day to day who are doing them. Mm-hmm. So you're like, oh, mm-hmm. this person's doing, you know, runs trails in a way I'm inspired, or does workouts. I realized a few years ago that I had like curated just a whole list of crazy people. Like, I'm just like, I need to unfollow some of these people, because they're just like, I'm not going to name names, but I'm like, this man, I could feel the drag on myself, and I'm like, he runs 113 miles a week. Like, you know, to be honest, like a small part of me is like, that'd be awesome if I could do that. And I like was capable of it, and I wanted to, you know, all of the things necessary, but damn, if like another year didn't roll by and he was still running 110 miles a week, and it just was like, ah, and you start to be like, what am I seeing here? Like, what is this guy's life? You know?
Right.
But he came about in a totally well-meaning, like I started following him and interacting with him in a well-meaning way, because he was doing the thing I wanted to be doing. Mm-hmm. And I think so it feels tricky, because a certain amount of that is a positive, like, oh, look, other people do this crazy thing. I mean, I see in the trail world, right? Like running for 9 hours on Saturday is a valid thing to do. And I'm like, what?
It's a fine line. I think it takes a lot of self-awareness and self-control to be able to, you know, use these platforms in a healthy way. Because they're always coming at you with, you know, with stuff. And it's hard not to see what someone else is doing and, you know, wonder, why am I not doing that? Or why can't I do that? Or what do I need to do so that I can do that? And that's, you know, that's not a great place to be.
What I like is that you seem open to taking things in, not like endlessly, but like in a curated way. You recently published some of like your principles for, you know, good training. And mm-hmm. I thought that was a helpful foundation. But I am curious, like, with new, you know, we could throw out something as specific as like a double threshold that
that's a great example.
That rise in popularity. I would call you like not someone who jumps on every trend, but also your eyes open, your ears open. So how do you think about like, what are you listening for when like new trends, new studies, new?
The first thing I do is I check the source. Who is it coming from? That's super important. So if it's high level athletes and coaches, okay, I'm interested. If Mike Smith's using double thresholds, I want to know why he's using double thresholds, type of thing. Then it's looking at the history of, just to use double thresholds as an example, this type of training. It's actually not as new and novel as people make it out to be. This sort of training has been around for a couple decades at this point. It's not like it was just invented a year or two ago. And I think that's where sometimes the messaging around a lot of these things gets muddled. We see it now with, you know, to pick on another topic, just cold exposure and stuff like Sodom. Mm-hmm. Things have been around forever type of thing. Yeah. These are not a new discovery. So, you know, I always check the source first. Then I look at the history. So I'm looking at the history of, you know, if it's a particular training modality. And I've always done this. I'm just like, all right, let me just go down the rabbit hole. Let me go down the rabbit hole and see what I can, you know, find on this. So I look at like what some of the new, mostly popular literature is saying, but then I go and I look, you know, through studies if they exist. I look through biographies, just training logs that I can find and see, you know, okay, is this something that's been happening for a while? Okay. Well, then what's the main point of it? Double threshold, people see, you know, I think they don't look past the surface of, oh, you're doing two like threshold workouts a day. Well, you know, what's the whole point? The whole point of it is intensity control. That's really like what it comes down to, especially when, you know, especially with the Norwegians like monitoring lactate so closely. It's not so much about like the exact lactate number. It's that they're controlling the intensity so that you can do that volume of work, because a lot of people just see them like, all right, well, I'm just gonna do two threshold workouts a day. Well, they don't control the intensity. And then what happens? They just fry themselves, you know, or they end up getting hurt. So, you know, I think it's really understanding like, okay, you know, what is this really, you know, about? And then for me, I look at it and say, is this a practical application? Especially when I'm thinking about it, like for my athletes. In 9.9 out of 10 cases, no, it is not. You know, for a number of reasons. One, I think it's just lifestyle and available time. The number of athletes that I have who could do two work, like run twice a day, never mind like two actual serious workouts a day, you know, is not very high. Two, it's like, then you can't just do something once and hope that it's going to have an effect. Is this something that they can build into, you know, their program and do consistently? Again, 9.9 out of 10 times, no, because most of the athletes that I coach and most of the athletes listening to this have lives, have kids, have jobs, have a lot of things, you know, going on, and you got to be able to recover from this higher workload. So no. And then two, it's like, I'm like, okay, most of the people who are like double threshold, that's it. That's what I got to do. It's like, well, have you like threshold running is important. Have you like tried maxing out the amount of threshold work that you can do in a single session before you do two? And the reason why you probably haven't been able to max it out is because you've been going too hard anyway. So it's like, it's not the magic bullet that it is, that it's proven to be. And this is also coming from like professional athletes who have all the time in the world to do this and the resources, right, you know, to recover, and who are trying to, you know, maximize that final like 3 to 5%. Whereas again, most people, need to take care of the first 95% first, and they're not even close to doing that. So, you know, a lot of that's, I don't know, it's kind of a muddled explanation, but it's sort of the lens that I look at something like that through. So I'll look at, you know, again, like I'll look at history. I'll look at where it's, I'll look at source, I'll look at history, I'll look at how it's being applied. I'll look at what it's really trying to, you know, do, and then make a decision based on that. I mean, I like to be aware of this stuff, but I mean, I can say with certainty, and I mean, I've been coaching runners for close to 20 years now. I don't think there's been anything that's really come along in the last like 20 years that I have like stopped on a dime and said, oh, nope, that's the way to do it. You know, Alex Hutchinson had this great line in an article that he wrote once, and I've since borrowed it. He goes, the wheel keeps getting reinvented, but it's still a wheel. And I think that is just so true with a lot of this stuff that that comes out, whether it's, you know, new training modality, new ways to recover. It's like, this is the real wheel being reinvented. But, you know, at the end of the day, if you really like look at all those things I just talked about, it's still a wheel.
Yeah. Just going back to your recent post that you shared, that was, like Peter had mentioned, just sort of like a groundwork of your training philosophies. One that I really, really liked was your mention of intensity on a spectrum, and just the fact that precision is an illusion. That just really like struck a chord for me, because I feel like so often, even for myself as an athlete, I'm like, in my mind, because I've been doing this a long time, I know like the number that I want to see for like threshold work. And the reality is coming back from injury right now, I'm not going to be hitting those numbers for a bit. It's going to take me a while to build back into that type of fitness. But just having this understanding that it's not like this RPE scale of, right, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 out of 10. I really loved that you mentioned that it's a spectrum, and that, like, you know, nailing the workout is an illusion, right? And there's like many ways to do that. I'm just wondering if you can speak a little bit more to that.
Yeah, well, I feel like this day and age, whether it's running or other aspects of our life completely separate from that, we have more access than ever to incredible amounts of data, and we can track everything. I mean, you know, most runners wear a watch, and even some of the most basic GPS watches now. I mean, I have a pretty basic GPS watch, so it gets time, it gets pace, it gets distance. But at the end, if I look at it, it's also giving me wrist-based heart rate. It's giving me an estimated power. You know, it's usually giving me like some kind of, you know, readiness score, VO2 max. I'm like, how the hell is this thing giving me VO2 max? I'm not breathing into the damn thing. Like, it's just like, you can get all of this data. And even outside of running, you know, your Apple Watch tells you how many steps you had per day, what your pulse ox is, like all of this stuff. And I say this to my athletes all the time, and I think it applies, again, outside of the scope of athletics, but we are not programmable robots. We are human beings, and data is important, but there are a number of things on any given day that are going to affect whatever the metric is, your pace, your heart rate, you know, your power. Some of those things are in your control. Some of those things are not. So I think, you know, that's, again, back to what I was saying earlier, data drives a discussion, the discussion drives a decision. And I feel like a lot of people cut out that discussion part, and whether that discussion is with your coach, with your doctor, with yourself, you know, it's important to, like, just use your brain and, like, try and understand, like, okay, why was my heart rate elevated today? Type of thing, or why was my typical tempo pace of 6 minutes per mile just feeling so much harder today? I see this as a coach, and I'm sure you do, Stephanie, as a coach. Peter, you're working with athletes too all the time. I can't understand, like, why this was so hard. Okay, well, let's, like, just start asking some questions. How have you been sleeping? What other stresses are going on in your life? What were the weather conditions like? And sometimes it takes several rounds of questions to, like, figure it out, and sometimes it might just be a bad day, and that's okay. But I don't know if it comes from insecurity or what, but I think, you know, today, especially with running, there is just this attraction to precision. I want to get everything, like, down to, like, the exact, like, you know, tenth of a second. And it's just like, get yourself in the ballpark. That's it. You know, I say this as a coach all the time. Like, it's never going to be perfect. You know, the old trope, perfect can't be the enemy of good. Like, let's just get a good enough workout in. And I think, you know, it's like, whether you run, you know, just to use pace, cause it's an easy one. Like, if your tempo pace is 6 minutes per mile, if you run 5:58 or 6:02, there's no difference. You know, there's very little difference. Now, if you run, like, you know, 6:30s, okay, well, let's ask, like, if you're off, like, by that much, like, let's figure out why it's, like, so far off. But it's like, just get yourself in the ballpark. And most people can do that, I think, most of the time. And to me, like, as an athlete, but also as a coach, that's less stressful to being like, I've got to be exactly here, exactly here, exactly here, because it still doesn't guarantee that, you know, if you get everything down to, like, the 10th of a second, or, like, to the exact millimole, or to the exact, like, heartbeat, like, 100 days in a row, it still doesn't guarantee that the race is going to go exactly to, you know, to plan, because something's going to happen during that race, and you're going to have to make adjustments. And, like, you may make some of those adjustments based on the data that you're getting, but at the end of the day, like, you've got to be able to look at that and be like, yeah, I either, like, don't trust that, or, okay, like, I'm just, you know, really tired, and I need to, like, make sure that I keep things steady here, because if I try to push it too much too early, I'm going to blow up, like, that type of thing.
Thanks for sharing that. I just think that's such an important piece, right, to the puzzle, that I don't feel like it's spoken about enough.
Yeah. And what's interesting too, I've spent a lot of time around high level athletes on the track and on the roads, and they have access to a lot of this stuff. Most of them aren't running with, you know, a heart rate monitor or super fancy watch, or in some cases, like, a, you know, a watch at all. And I think, you know, and some of them do, you know, some of them do get a lot more specific about it. But I think those who have had some of the longest careers and have, again, like, a good relationship with the sport, and it's fitting well, you know, into their life, they identify, like, you know, usually it's between 2 and 4 key metrics that they want to keep track on, and they know kind of, you know, ballpark, like, where they're going to be on a given day, and they don't overthink it, you know, beyond that. They just try to get themselves, again, in the ballpark. They're not worried about everything being so precise all the time.
I've often thought about how, like, there is a cost for measurement. I was thinking about with some of the athletes I coach, like, if I could get their weight every day or every few days, like, I think it would be interesting maybe to know, are they dehydrated or is their body composition changing? But just speaking at this point in time, I would never ask someone to weigh themselves because of all of the effect that it would occur. So I'm curious, like, is there certain data that rises to the top of, like, well, they all fall, can succumb to the tribulations you just discussed, but like some are more helpful for a virtual coach or just coach at a distance than others?
Yeah, it's a good question. So even before we get into the running specific data, I encourage all my athletes to get a comprehensive blood panel at least once a year, twice if they can swing it, just so that they have a baseline and they kind of know, you know, what their ranges are. Because I've seen this a lot over the years. Like, some of the most common issues are, you know, low iron or low ferritin levels, or at least just understanding like what your, you know, what your baseline is. Because sometimes when we run into trouble and we can't understand, okay, why is this person just been dragging for, you know, weeks on end? Why is every workout hard? I'd say more often than not, if they get some blood work and we have something to compare it to, like, some levels are off. So I think you kind of got to know like what your baseline is. I think that's just good for Stephanie, you're the doctor, but I think just like, you know, general health, you know, overall, sure. But I think especially as an athlete with, you know, high performance goals, I think you should know, you know, what your metabolic ranges are. Then two, going into data, it's going to depend on the athlete. I mean, for my marathoners, especially, most marathoners have a time goal. They're trying to set a personal best, they're trying to break a barrier, they're trying to qualify for this or that. And it's a very like clear number, you know, Olympic trials, 237, 218, Boston, you know, 5 minute increments, 3 hours, 305, 310, so on and so forth. Barriers, 3 hours, 4 hours, you know, et cetera. So pace is important. Total running time, I think, is important. You know, volume you can measure in terms of time, you know, or distance. Most all my athletes now have a GPS watch. So, you know, getting the distance, you know, is important. I look at heart rate as something, you know, after the fact. And I do also try to understand, like, all right, are we getting that heart rate reading off of a chest strap? Is it coming from the watch? Is it coming from an armband? Because that will affect the accuracy of the data. But, you know, assuming we're getting accurate data, that's something that I'll look at after the fact, because one thing I look for is just like trends and patterns, you know, over time. And I feel like heart rate's an interesting one to look at, because you get to realize where someone is when they're running truly easy, where they are, if they're in more of like a threshold zone, if they're doing VO2 max work, you know, where they end up, you know, what they can hold for a half marathon race, you know, that type of thing. And sometimes, again, like, back to data can drive the discussion drives the decision. If we see, like, if someone tells me, and this is, I wouldn't say it's common, but it's not uncommon, but I couldn't get my heart rate up. It's like, okay, well, let's look at what that number was relative to, you know, what you've been able to do in the past, and then start asking the appropriate questions and figure out, like, okay, why is that? Are you fighting, you know, something off? You know, is there something else going on? So, you know, I think those, for me, like, those are the main ones. With my trail and ultra athletes, most of them are racing on the trails for the most part. So depending on the race that they're getting ready for, we'll certainly look at vertical gain per mile. And, you know, that's important when planning training, because we want to try and mimic some of the, as best we can, given where they are, like, mimic some of the environments that they're going to be racing in. So it's good to know, like, all right, well, what does that look like? Is it gaining 300 feet per mile? Is it gaining 700 feet per mile? Is it rolling? How can we simulate that type of stuff? So it's going to depend on, you know, the individual, but those are the main ones that I'm looking at. I have some athletes who have a power meter and they'll run with that. My confidence isn't totally there yet with that technology. It'll get better, and I think that might be something similar to heart rate that I'll look at, you know, after the fact, and see, you know, where trends develop, what the patterns look like. Being able to take lap splits, so when we are doing interval workouts, I can segment that and break it down to, like, all right, where were you during your intervals? Where were you during your recovery periods? You know, and that's looking at, you know, the amount of time they spent at that intensity. You know, if pace is something that's important, looking at the pace. Again, like, afterward, looking at, you know, potentially the heart rate, potentially power, you know, that sort of thing. But it's, yeah, I mean, I'm not really looking at, like, I don't have anyone pricking their fingers and doing lactate readings or, you know, taking biopsies or anything like that.
I'm curious. I believe you've run as far as 50 miles, or raced as far as 50 miles.
Correct. Yep.
What is it like being a coach for, you know, events you know very well as a first person versus I could also see you being like a very experienced, objective analyst of, you know, UTMBs and like you have a lot of data over a lot of years from like not personal experience, but having looked at these things from the outside. What's it like coaching on like two sides of that fence?
I love it all. I'm just endlessly, I've always been endlessly curious about how people train to do the thing. You know, I would, even going back to high school, and this is in the late 90s, and the internet certainly wasn't anything near where it was now, and our access to information isn't anything near where it was now. I mean, I just loved looking at whatever like training logs I could get my hands on. And if I'm good at anything, I think it's pattern recognition. And I would just look and be like, all right, well, what are the pattern, if depending how comprehensive of a log I could get, like, you know, what are the patterns in their training or throughout, like, you know, a data set of people's training that tend to, like, you know, emerge that have helped them to achieve their, you know, in this case it was like, you know, their best early on would be like their best mile or their best 2 mile or 5k and eventually, you know, sort of marathon. And I didn't get interested in ultra running until I moved to the Bay Area in 2014, just because there's a huge community of ultra runners here. And this is somewhat still the case, but in 2014, there were just, I mean, just some of the best ultra runners in the country right in backyard, on both the men's and women's side. And again, it was just curiosity. I mean, I'd be running with Dylan Bowman and Alex Varner or Jorge Maravilla, and just, how do you train for these things? Like, I don't know. It was so out of, you know, just so out of my world at the time. And as I'm apt to do, I would just pick up whatever books that existed, and there weren't many at the time. And I would just see what I could learn from them, and then see what I could learn from the people that I was surrounded by. And then as I was because I was working at Competitor at the time, I'd go to a lot of these events, and I would just talk to other, you know, coaches and athletes there and just try to learn, you know, as much as possible. And I mean, that curiosity still drives me today, whether it's the mile or, you know, an ultra marathon, is like, just, you know, what do we need to do to be successful at these things? And, you know, Tim was the first ultra athlete, one of the first ultra athletes that I coached and I still coach. And I remember saying to Tim, and he comes from a very similar background to me, where he ran cross country and track. And, you know, he reached out to me about coaching, and I said, I have never run an ultra. I've never coached another ultra runner. I just want to be clear about that from the get-go. If, you know, you are willing to try and figure this out with me, then let's give it a shot. And he said, yeah, let's figure it out together. And that's sort of the, you know, the approach that we took into it. So I knew a bit about how he had trained to that point and the type of training that he had been exposed to. And then I would look at these, you know, events that he wanted to run and was prepping for, and they were very, you know, very different in a lot of ways. And really just, you know, kind of experimented with, you know, some of the training, and we got a lot of things right. And, you know, there were other things that we needed to change over time. And I coached a few other, you know, athletes early on, Caroline Bowler. And she, you know, she ran ultras and marathons, but she was more focused on the flatter, faster ultras. She would run 50K, you know, flatter 50Ks. I think she still has maybe the 50-mile world best, or, you know, she made a US 100K team. I'm like, oh, well, this is different. She's not climbing mountains. I don't really have to worry so much about the vertical gain, but, you know, we're anywhere from 8K longer to a marathon, or like almost, you know, 40 miles longer than a marathon. So, okay, well, what do we do? And I feel like the marathon formula was, I don't want to say like tried and true, but you knew what the key elements were that you had to get in there. So I was thinking about these other events, and I'm like, okay, well, what do we need to get in here? You know, what overlaps from what I know is traditional marathon training? What do we need to do differently? And I mean, some of it was just trial and error, and fortunately trust on the part of the athletes to, you know, help me, you know, guide them there. But it's just curiosity, I think, at the end of the day, that continues to drive me and keep me interested in these things. And it's, I think that's why I also work with a very wide range of athletes. I don't work with like true beginners. Everyone has, you know, some baseline level of experience, but I work with everyone from milers to multi-day ultra marathoners. Sure. And I, you know, I enjoy that. It keeps things interesting for me. I mm-hmm. take, you know, and I can take from one athlete and apply to, you know, another and just learn some things. And I think that's been some of the best education that I've ever had as a coach, just working yeah. with that wide range of athletes. Cause you see this, you know, I'm a marathon coach, I'm an ultra running coach, I'm a track coach, sure. Type of thing. And no fault at all to, you know, any of those folks. If you're comfortable coaching, you know, that type of athlete and that's your world, great. I'm interested in all of it. And I'm super curious about all of it. And, you know, I have a lot of overlap too, especially between many of my marathoners and ultra runners. I mean, Caroline yeah. is a good example of that. Tim came from a marathon background. I've been trying to get him to, you know, line up for another marathon. He has no interest in doing that. But, you know, I like kind of going back and forth with some of them, you know, as yeah. well.
Well, Mario, we want to be like super respectful of your time. I'm going to ask you like maybe like one final question, at least sure. on my end. This might be a little bit more of a selfish question just because I am one of those athletes and ultra runners who I actually really enjoy like the flat stuff. I also enjoy mm-hmm. the mountain stuff too. And I'm also, I think at this point, like I found my strength to be right around like the 12-hour to 100-mile distance. But yeah. I also love to rip like a road 10K, like or a couple of them, like over the summer, like leading into like a fall 100-miler. But I'm curious, like what you already mentioned, right, of someone like Tim and some of like the ultra athletes that you coach coming from a background in track, cross country, mm-hmm. Or road marathoning. Have you noticed any like common denominators in terms of maybe like maintaining speed, right? Maintaining that sort of like flat road speed, but then also, of course, like you mentioned, specificity is key, right? Like you're not going to train your athletes lining up at Western States in the same way you're going to train them lining up for the 50K World Championships.
Right.
But have you noticed just common denominators or maybe things over the years as a coach in order to sort of keep those athletes who do enjoy both of those worlds in the sport, ways to just keep them sharp?
It's all important. It just all can't be important at the same time. So right. I think just where we shift that emphasis is going to depend on, you know, where the athlete is like in their build up to a specific race, but also if we're taking a longer term view, like just where they are in their overall evolution as an athlete. And, you know, I'll look at someone's history. And if, and this is not uncommon, a lot of folks come into mm-hmm. ultra running, like now people are coming in from that track and cross country right, background yeah. and moving mm-hmm. up. But for several years, and many of the athletes I've worked with, like that was their entry into the sport. They may have mm-hmm. played like lacrosse or some other non-running sport before that, but they got right in ultra running and their first race was a 50K or a 50 miler. Mm-hmm. And they love going long on the trails, you know, as many days as you'll let them go. But the thought of going to the track and ripping some 400s is not appealing to them. Well, guess what? Sometimes you got to do things that you don't like to do. Mm. You got to eat your vegetables. But it's important that as a mm-hmm. well-rounded athlete, you know, you work on both ends of
yeah.
you know the spectrum. So in that case, you know, I may take that type of athlete and we'll spend a period of time just developing, like, not only their speed, but their relative comfortability at like those shorter types of distances, maybe doing a bit more VO2 max work, dropping their volume, doing things that are a little speedier and snappier than they're used to, because that's a new stimulus and they're going to respond really, really mm-hmm. well to that. Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, if their strength is, you know, running long and they can just go all day, we don't want to get too far away from that. But again, like you can't do everything all of the time. So, you know, it's going to depend on, you know, on where we are, but we'll spend a period of time working on that. You know, on the flip side, if I have someone who comes from a track or cross country background and they're showing some interest in, we'll just say ultra running, because that's not uncommon these days anymore. It's like, okay, well, I know what your strengths are. I know what your background is. And you also respond really well to that. So we want to make sure we don't get too far away from it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, mm-hmm. we're trying to do something completely different and develop a new skill set. So, you know, for some period of time, we may do like less of that and more of this, so that we can get you comfortable with like just being on your feet for a longer period of time, what that fueling looks like, what the toll on your body is like, you know, so on and so forth. But, you know, we'll still do a little of the type of work that you're used to because you respond really well to that and you enjoy it, you know, mm-hmm. as well. So we want to make sure that we're doing a good job like marrying those things. So that's something I'm always just trying to keep keep in mind as a coach and I'm writing a program is like, okay, what is this person's background? What do they like to do? What do they respond really well to? And then what do we need to do to get ready for whatever it is that they are prepping for? And how much time do we have? And then how do we, like, how do we make all of that work? And to me, like, that's where I get to use my brain a lot and like get creative. And I have a very creative side of my brain. And that's like one of the things I enjoy about coaching is that creative aspect of it. It's like, okay, like, I've read all the books, I've talked to all the people, I've seen all the things, but, you know, I'm also not afraid to like do something different and get creative and be like, all right, how can we like accomplish all the things that we want to, you know, accomplish? And that may look, you know, and it does, it looks different from athlete to athlete, but that's one of my favorite aspects of coaching.
This feels like a non sequitur, but it's not. One of Mario's favorite workouts personally is hills and 200s, which he has given to me and I have very much enjoyed. And then almost 100%, when I have given that workout to my athletes, they've really enjoyed it. I think there's something about that type of stimulus that is like not that threatening, but sort of exhilarating. Because I've noticed, you know, any number of things you're talking about, you push. Our jobs as coaches is to push people slightly towards the things they're avoiding on their own volition. And something like that is just like a breath of fresh air, fun stimulus. And it's like playing running or something.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite workouts, and it's one that my college coach gave me a version of that I really enjoyed back in the early 2000s, and other coaches have put their own spin on it. And I do have athletes who hate that workout. So not everyone, okay. But good. I think a lot of people do tend to like it is one, the reps are pretty short. They're generally, you know, if we go by time, like 30 to 45 seconds, like per hard push, whether that's the hill or, you know, the 200s or strides. In college, we did 30-30s, 30 second hills, 30 seconds on a flat. You can do 200 meters each way, but either way, it's generally less than a minute of, you know, faster running. And like, that's easy for people to wrap their heads around. It's like, oh, I can do that. I can do it for less than a minute. That's no problem. Two minutes, maybe not, but less than a minute, I can do that. And then I get a little bit
for
of,
that long.
Yeah. And then I get a little bit of a break. And then the fact that it is like hills and flats, so you're also changing up, you know, just that aspect of it, you're manipulating that variable. It makes it a different workout. You're like, oh, I'm not just doing 20 200 meter hills. I'm doing like 10 of these and like 10 of those. And sometimes you can alternate back and forth type of thing. So I think just that, you know, that novelty, I can't really explain this, but it's good for the brain. Like it just breaks things up a little bit. And it makes it a little more interesting, you know, in that way. So, I mean, that's my hunch as to why people like it, but you also get a lot out of the workout. I mean, you know, you're running hard, you get your heart rate up, you know, the hills really help with, you know, especially at those types of intensities, just like working on your mechanics a little bit. Then you get to change gears, like, you know, running a little bit flatter. And I think, you know, whether you're training for the mile, which I'm doing that right now, I've done some version of that workout a couple times recently, or even with an ultra athlete who, you know, is being introduced to like shorter speed work. It's like, okay, this is a good entry point. You know, it's like they're short enough reps. We can control the intensity. I'm not going to let you go overboard with it. It's usually a very novel stimulus. And they're like, oh, that wasn't so bad. But then again, because they're used to like, you know, longer, steadier types of things, all of a sudden they're like, oh my goodness, like I just feel poppier on my easy runs and like some of my other workouts feel better. So it's a fun workout. Hills and twos. Check it out.
It's a fun one. We know you have to get going soon, but we really appreciate your time and jamming with us. I'm sure that we'll be in touch again. Stephanie, anything before we sign off?
I don't think so. Mario, thank you so, so much for your time. This was a wonderful conversation that I personally really enjoyed, and we're just so appreciative of you coming on with us.
Yeah, me as well. Thank you for asking me, and maybe we'll get to do it again someday soon.
Yeah.
Awesome.
All right.
Have a good day.
Take care. Thanks.